Welcome to Designed for More, brought to you by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Join Dr. Timothy Jennings, a renowned expert in psychiatry, neuroscience, and spiritual well-being, as he explores the connections between mind, body, spirit, and relationships.
Hello, and welcome to Designed for More, sponsored by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. I'm Dr. Tim Jennings. I'm joined today by James Johnson, our Chief of Chaplains, and Brett Durbin, one of our chaplains here, and also works with our ministry partners here at Honey Lake. And today we're going to be talking about why we self-sabotage. Why do we self-sabotage? And we can have a conversation, but for me, the topic means why our actions are in some way connected to, motivated to self-sabotage, to undermine our success, not the innocent mistakes that we might make that may cause us a problem and give us a setback. I'm not talking about that. We're talking about actions that are actually a pattern of decision-making that sabotage our success. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. We can certainly talk about innocent mistakes that we make that might give us a setback, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the stuff that would cause people to be in patterns of behavior that are actually sabotaging their own success and well-being. Yeah, any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I can look at myself and just think when there was times that was happening and that maybe there was a subconscious fear of, you know, failure or change, or that maybe I'm not worthy. And I get in my own way, you know, and I don't even realize I'm doing it necessarily. It might be even visible to those around me, but that there's some kind of fear driving it. At least that's how, I guess, when I think of that whole self-sabotage thing, I think of fear.
I think you're exactly right. I think we're going to find it's going to be related to fear with different flavors of fear. If you understand, I move a different flavors.
Yeah, yeah. I was thinking shame, but the root of shame is also fear. So, yeah.
Yeah, so shame.
If I feel like I'm not worthy of this or whatever, like, you know, I get a promotion at work and I feel like, oh, I don't deserve that promotion, and I end up doing such a poor job, or I end up, you know, not end up, you know, feeling like I can take it because, oh, I'm not worthy of that honor. You know, that's somebody should go to somebody else. Well, you know, that's rooted in my lack of self-worth and my feelings of shame.
Okay. Fear of mistake making.
Mm-hmm.
Fear of not being good enough. Fear of responsibility. Fear of letting people down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fear of embarrassment. Yeah.
Fear of embarrassment. Believing lies about oneself. You're not good enough.
Mm-hmm.
You don't deserve this. You're too broken. You're too bad a sinner. You're too ugly. The lies people believe. Could these be?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Lack of confidence in oneself. Mistakes, having made innocent mistakes, but made them often.
Mm-hmm.
Then they sabotage because they just don't have confidence in themselves. Have you seen people self-sabotage?
Oh, yeah.
What kinds of things have you seen? What's it look like?
I knew a lady who had been married multiple times, and every time she would get, and from appearances, you know, from the outside looking in, the husband in the marriage was loving and supportive and trying to live a godly life, and they'd be married for a few years, and some of them have children, and then she would just, out of fear, you know, and mental health struggles, she would leave. Every time she was so afraid to be, you know, comfortable and satisfied, she would rather be living in discomfort and despair because that was something that to her was more comfortable than having peace and happiness in her life.
Yeah, so that goes to a certain flavor of fear. And if you dig into that, now I'm glad I don't know who that is.
Right.
So I can't be disclosing any confidential stuff I have no idea who this was, but. You know, thinking as a psychiatrist there, you're probably dealing with somebody who has trauma issues in their life.
Mm-hmm.
They're having some abuse issues in their life. And that early childhood distress internalized distortions about the self. And then those distortions about the self led to patterns of decisions that, as you described, that they then look back on and they take some ownership over the decision like I chose to leave.
Yeah.
Okay. But and that piles on more guilt and shame, but they don't recognize that that decision was actually a symptom of unresolved other stuff that they never actually dealt with, that they didn't choose to have. Those are wounds inflicted to them, but they've never actually wrestled through them. Why? And why wouldn't they wrestle through them? Why? Why would people not wrestle through wounds like that?
Uncomfortable.
It's painful.
That's correct. Yeah. That's exactly correct, because it's painful, and often shameful,
mm-hmm.
not legitimate shame. And many people get confused about this. Legitimate shame is the shame, in my view, that comes from doing something shameful.
Right.
Okay. You have done evil to a person, raped, pillaged, murdered, whatever. Mm-hmm. And you feel shame after that. That shame is appropriate because you did shameful things. Most people that I have as patients, their shame is actually not appropriate. Their shame is the shame of what happened to them. So they were the rape. I have a college student get raped. She's done nothing wrong, but she feels shame. Her shame is not appropriate to herself. The event that happened, the act of somebody doing, that's a shameful act, but that's not her act. That's mm-hmm. the other person's. You following me?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it's important because the resolution of shame is different. And if a person is carrying shame that is not their own, what's the solution for that? In other words, this rape, she has to work through her trauma. She has to come to peace with how this event changed her view and experience of herself, with the truth that that act did not define her any more than crucifying Christ and stripping him naked and beating him publicly defined him as a bad person. He wasn't bad. The people who did that were bad. And so there has to be this reprocessing where they go, that was an awful experience and it felt awful. And those feelings are appropriate to that experience, but they're not appropriate to me. I'm still an innocent. My soul is still, my conscience is clear. My soul is not sullied by this. But what happens is when an uncomfortable thing happens, people can internalize that and make it part of how they feel about themselves. The younger they are that these things happen, the more vulnerable they are to that happening. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. That makes sense, yeah. And you know, is there a sense of control that comes with some of this? Like, you know, the world, you know, so many things in my life have been so chaotic that at least I can control if I leave the relationship. I can control if I quit the job. I can control
you're exactly right. So what happens though, here's another type of self-sabotage. Speaking of relationship, is somebody who has had been burned. It could be a parent-child relationship where they were exploited and thus their trust was breached severely by a parent who mm-hmm. exploited them. Okay. So that's if I get close to people, they burn me. I can't trust them. So there is this fear of trust, but because we're creating the image of God, they have a longing. They want to be in a love relationship. They want connection. So they'll pursue relationship, but it can only get so close before then the panic and fear of being hurt again because of that prime relationship that exploited them and they've never worked through the trauma. They haven't resolved that yet. They anticipate then, if I get to the point I can really trust like this, I'll get burned again. I'll get exposed. It's not safe, but I long for it. So they move in to a point and then they sabotage the relationship as a means of protecting themselves from getting burned again. Okay. Yeah. If I cheat, he can't cheat on me,
mm-hmm.
et cetera. If I end it, then they can't dump me type thing. And so there's this pattern of sabotage that happens a lot in relationships driven by fear and insecurity, often from unresolved wounds of the past. Could be childhood wounds with dysfunctional, abuse in the childhood. Could be that later you were burned in an important intimate relationship. You know, your spouse cheated and left you for another person. And you didn't work through and heal that loss. And then as you start to date again, you can only get so close and you have to sabotage the relationship because you still haven't healed the brokenheartedness of the first loss. And you anticipate getting, in other words, you have trouble trusting and you anticipate, and it's safer for you to be in control and end it.
Right. Absolutely. So we'd say this is more of a software issue, a thinking pattern problem.
So. That's an interesting way you said that, because the thinking always is happening on the platform of the brain.
Okay.
So
So this, the software interacts with the hardware.
Yes.
Right.
And it's the hardware responses that are causing the emotional reactions.
Mm-hmm.
But the hardware is responding to the perceptions, patterns of thought that the mind is thinking.
Okay.
So yes, it's a software issue, but intimately interacting with the neurobiology. And the neurobiology, if you do this repetitively, anything repetitively, you create habit patterns for.
Mm-hmm.
You know how to drive a standard four on the floor vehicle with a clutch?
Right, yeah.
Okay. Do you remember learning? Grinding some gears was awkward.
Yeah.
Okay. But once you've learned, your brain wires it in.
Mm-hmm.
And you can be having conversations, listening to music. You're not even thinking about gearing. It's like, oh yeah, I must have. How many times did you shift in the last 20 miles on the back roads? I wasn't counting. I have no idea. Okay, you're just automatically doing it. There's just no thought about it, okay? Mm-hmm. Well, so if you have these patterns of negative thinking and relating enough, you can wire that in so that, that the brain triggers these things instead of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
These are habit patterns. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think that was crucial because sometimes you can tell somebody, hey, you self-sabotage that, or hey, you have a pattern, a history of doing this. And they keep doing it even after they've been told. And I think that makes perfect sense.
And so how do you break habits then of any kind? All of us brush our teeth and whichever hand you use, right, left, doesn't matter. That's the hand you use and you'll put the brush in a certain position in your mouth to start and you go through in the same pattern every time. Is that not true?
Oh yeah.
It's a habit. It takes very little effort. These are adaptive habits. You can wire that in so you don't have to use a lot of mental focus and processing attention. Life is not exhausting when you have healthy habits. But if you've read a study, and their studies are out there, show, well, if I actually teach myself to do it with my opposite hand, that actually requires my brain to make new neural pathways, which turns on proteins that keeps my brain healthy, reduces my risk of dementia as I age. That's all true. And so you say, you know what? I just saw that study. I'm convinced. I choose to start brushing with my opposite hand. You make that choice during our conversation today. Tonight, when your wife's talking to you and you go in to brush your teeth, what's going to happen? You're going to brush with your routine hand. And then you're going to get into bed and you're going to go, oh, I was going to brush with the other hand. And at that moment, do you go, I'm stupid. I can't learn. I'm broken beyond repair. Why do I even try? I'm useless. I give up. Or do you simply go, well, of course I did it with that hand because I wasn't thinking about it and I haven't wired that in yet. This is all habit. No matter what the habit is. Okay. And if you want to actually learn with the other hand, you have to get up and go brush your teeth again with the new hand. And the next day, you might do the same thing. And the third day, you might be halfway through with your routine hand and you remember, oh no, okay, and you switch right in the middle, okay, and over the course of time, you actually, with repeated effort and intention, you begin establishing, and then eventually you wire in the new, and the old will then begin pruning back when you stop using it. All behavior changes this way, including the self-sabotage behavior. When they realize they're doing it, they first need to have recognition as I am doing it. They need to be able to identify what are the triggers to that. And then they need to have in place some type of a plan that helped them to anticipate where that's going to occur. But even with all good intentions, they will still sometimes find themselves doing the old thing. This is Romans chapter 7. The good I want to do, sometimes I don't do. And the bad that I don't want to do anymore, sometimes I find myself doing. That's exactly right, because that converted person is in the process of establishing sanctified habit patterns and wiring out the old ones that they wired in before they actually became converted.
Mm.
And it's a process.
I tried the toothbrush thing.
Yeah.
And I lasted 5 days, and I did have to consciously think about it, but then I traveled, and I apparently at some point just started doing it with my right hand again. And I didn't even recognize it until like a week later. I had just been brushing with my right again. And I'm like, oh gosh, I was actually attempting to do this. And I didn't even realize that I had gone back to the comfortable way. And so, yeah, I have to start again.
So here's another example of this. Even when you were in the positioning yourself to where environment helps you.
Yeah.
You know how to drive the four on the floor.
Right.
You go to England. The driver's seat's on the other side. You have to shift with your left hand.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That whole setup helps you recognize that it's your left hand. But it's still, because it's new, it's very awkward. And so you're not smooth at it, but you're focusing on it. It helps remind you that's what you're doing. Okay. But then some child runs out in front of you. You got to gear down really fast. You're grabbing the door handle. So even when you are paying attention, until it's wired in the urgent situations where you're responding without thought, the brain will still activate and you're grabbing the right door handle, not the gear shifter. Am I right or wrong?
No, that makes perfect sense.
Okay. And this is Romans 7. And that's why this guy in Romans 7, in my opinion, is not in rebellion against God. You see, as soon as he does the old thing he doesn't want to do, he goes, oh, what a wretched man am I. Who will save me from this body of death? He doesn't want to be. I didn't mean to grab the door handle, trying to shift down, okay? But I haven't gotten that wired in yet. I'm not smooth at that yet, okay? That man in Romans 7 is still in a beautiful saving relationship and being transformed by that decision-making process. These people who want to overcome self-sabotage first have to recognize that they have self-sabotage, and then they have to be willing to look at truth. What are they? Typically, the self-saboteur is a person who has stuff in their life that they don't want to deal with. So sometimes it's the guilt, shame stuff. Sometimes it's the fear of rejection stuff, and so they keep sabotaging because they don't want to be rejected. Sometimes it's anger at somebody else. Classically, I see this at kids who become adults, and they have some unresolved anger toward their parents. And their self-sabotage is a way of punishing their parents, hurting their parents. The 3-year-old, if you don't let me miss him, can't even hold my breath, the 3-year-old is taking action against itself in order to hurt the parent. Same dynamic, but now it's actually unconsciously being lived out as they keep sabotage, and it just distresses the parents so much. Sometimes. Anybody that has, you shouldn't assume that that's what's going on. I said sometimes.
Right.
It's not always the case.
Yeah. How often does that happen with our father, you know, in terms of in a spiritual sense, that we're self-sabotaging as exactly the same way you just described, to basically either harm our parents or get back at our parents or whatever it may be with our relationship with God? You know, do you see that often with people where it's almost an anger at God? You know, it's a...
Not for people who've actually come to know God as Jesus revealed him to be.
Yeah.
Okay. But many times for people who have a belief in God, who is how the church has taught him to be. Ooh, did I say something that was contradictory? Is you mean the church doesn't teach God as like Jesus revealed him to be? Not all of them.
No,
some of them actually teach that Jesus and the Father are quite distinctly different.
Mm-hmm.
That Jesus is a loving Savior who would give his life to save you. And the Father is the being who needs the Son to present his blood to him so he won't hurt us.
Yeah, have that satisfaction.
Yeah, so they're not actually the same as Jesus taught, that if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. The Father and I are one, and the God, and the Bible teaches God was in the Son, reconciling the world to himself. So, you know, the Godhead are totally unified in perfection. There's no distinction between them in character.
Mm-hmm.
But many Christians do have a distinction. And if they have a distorted view of God, then yes, this can lead to lots of anger, frustration, acting. And I've seen this all the time. I've had patients. I've wrote about it in some of my books. Angry. Why did God want my child to have cancer?
Yeah, I had a very, maybe not painful, but difficult, that there's the popular passage that, you know, God, you knit me together in my mother's womb. You know, and a lot of people say, well, that means everything, single thing about me was exactly what God wanted, rather than recognizing how genetics works and how, yes, God created humanity in his image. But that, you know, that doesn't mean that God sat down and said, I'm choosing to knit you together with a chromosomal defect. And so God, that makes all of this God's fault in that person who has been taught it that way, rather than recognizing that psalm is poetic and it's meant to convey an emotional reaction. They actually believe that God literally created them that way. And then the parent is angry for God making their child that way, or the child grows up to be angry and resentful at God that way, rather than understanding what the context of that passage is actually talking about. And you end up with that anger.
So a couple points. I agree with you completely, totally on board with you, because I've had many patients that have had this, who have been taught that. God wanted you to have spinal bifida.
Yeah.
God knitted you together with a heart defect. When your mother was drinking 2 bottles of vodka, God wanted you to have fetal alcohol syndrome. God did that. Which is actually stronger, vodka or God?
No.
I think God's stronger.
Yeah.
So then how could anybody be born with fetal alcohol syndrome if God's doing the knitting?
That's right.
And so he knits through his ordained laws of health and the mechanisms he has built into our reproductive capacities that he delegated to us in his image that we have the capacity to create beings in our own image. Yes. And so this is his design, his construction, his life-sustaining protocols, the laws he's built into reality. But in fact, my view of that psalm is that it has nothing to do with reproduction. It has to do with salvation.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember, the psalmist who wrote that, and if you go back in the Hebrew and look at this, these words translated actually have can be translated seat of emotions,
mm-hmm.
heart, rather than, and it's not talking about embryologic development, it's talking about spiritual. And in Psalms 51, the psalmist has already written, I was born in sin, conceived in iniquity. And in this psalm, he's saying, even from my earliest conceptions, your grace was there to save me.
Mm-hmm.
Your salvation was there for me.
That's
already.
Right. Yeah.
That's what it's really describing there. From the darkest recesses, you know, you were knitting me together in salvation, my soul, not my body.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's what it's really talking
about. Oh, sure. You know, and, you know, just like we've talked about other passages that have been, you know, missing some of those linguistic or cultural contexts that we anglicize it and Americanize it to the point that it's making God into something he's not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but people who have those views then go to the question that they have a lot of anger at God and they connect that stuff out and they self-sabotage because, I'll show you then.
Oh, yeah. I've seen quite a few people that said, I did these substances or I treated my body this way in rebellion against God because I'm angry at him. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so what is the answer for the person who's angry at God?
They've got to experience him for who he really is.
Well, yeah. And so, and what wouldn't you say, tell him?
Yeah, well.
Tell him. Yeah. Tell him you're angry. In other words, have you ever had, you're a parent. Has any of your kids ever gotten angry at you?
Never.
Okay. And what would you want them to do?
Yeah, tell me all about it. Yeah,
tell me why you're angry.
Mm-hmm.
Not pretend. Not come to the dinner table and smile and go, thank you, Daddy, for this meal. Daddy is good and Daddy is great. Thank you, Daddy, for this meal. I hate you. I hate you. Okay.
Yeah. Right.
No, you don't want that. No. And many people have the, you know, I think have the anger, but they won't go to God and talk. I think he invites, come talk to me. Talk to me about it. Yeah. Share. Tell me why you're angry. Don't we find that in the Psalms and other places?
Well, and even in Job's situation, you know, Job wanted to present his case to God, and God loved him enough to show up and said, here I am. Let's talk about this. Now, Job didn't have anything to say in the presence of God, but God loved him enough to say, here I am. Let's talk about this.
And Isaiah 1:18, come, let us reason together, mm-hmm. though your sins are like scarlet. And God invites us to have this conversation. And I think one of the detriments that drives some of this is not only people have distortions about what they're taught about God's responsibility for say their birth or something, but that they're not allowed to ask questions. They're not allowed to go to him. They're not allowed to actually tell him because he'll get mad.
Yeah.
You know, he's more like an alcoholic father.
No.
Wow.
No.
Got to add that to the list. Alcoholic Jesus.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, I think so much of it comes down to, you know, our perception of, does God love me too? I hear that from a lot of people I talk to here is just, they're angry at God, but it's rooted more in I can't imagine that God would actually love me,
mm-hmm.
you know, and is that real? Because I think if you can embrace and, you know, really take to heart that he's a loving father, then it is different. Then you can come to him with that, you know, that struggle and even anger. And I'm mad at you, you know, because, you know, ultimately he loves you and he's there for you. And I think that's such a key thing that can be lost too. You can have a grip on that and then that starts to waver and you start wondering, maybe a bunch of things go wrong in your life and you start wondering, you know, does God really love me still? You know, because it sure doesn't feel like it.
Yeah.
And
that's one of the aspects of the atoning work of Jesus. My mentor pastor said it this way. He said that, you know, God's love is not determined by our circumstances. It was demonstrated at the cross. And, you know,
let's unpack that a minute. And then when I come back to
this,
I want to unpack that and take it in maybe a way. But I also want to come back and don't let me move away from the question of other ways people self-sabotage.
Okay.
Okay. But because I've heard this statement and never quite set well with me.
Okay.
There's nothing you can do to cause God to love you more. And there's nothing you can do to cause him to love you less. It's never set well with me.
Okay.
I don't think the way it's stated, it's factually wrong. It's just a misdirection.
Yes.
It's a misdirection. And that statement emotionally anesthetizes people mm-hmm. to cut themselves off from God's love, not to embrace it. Because That statement is about God's heart, God's attitude, and God is love. And of course, there's nothing you can do that can cause God to be more loving or less loving. He is love.
That's right.
Okay.
That was identity.
That's never been the question.
Yeah.
So when you talk about his attitude, his being, there's nothing you can do. But when you actually talk about how love functions, well, that's not true then. There is a lot you can do that cause God to love you less and or love you more. Not in his heart, but in how love functions. This is why John, the disciples, called John the beloved, or the one whom Jesus loved. Well, didn't he love them all? Yes, but how love functions, it requires a other to receive it and to participate in it and to reciprocate it. And then it grows, and that love can do more in that person's life as a parent, okay? Think about all the love and all the things you want to do and pour into your child. But if your child, for whatever reason, has a hard heart, the prodigal son runs away, won't be in your life, your heart is still full of love, but you can't functionally love that child.
Mm.
You can't let that flow into that child. You follow what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
There's no relationship.
Right. Yes. And there's no transforming power of love in the life of that part. So while it's nothing you can do to cause God to love you more or less in his heart, there's a lot you can do that can cause God's love to function more in your heart or not.
Yeah. It's a separating factor. I mean, yes, it's just like what sin is. Mm-hmm. You know, when you have sin in your life or something that's going on, there is a separation factor. You are separating yourself from God. It's not that he's running from you.
That's right.
You are pulling yourself away from him. And so I think we really have to take that to heart, you know, when we're feeling like, you know, well, God maybe loves me less now than he did before. No.
So my focus shifts it back to where the critical tipping point is. The tipping point in our salvation, as I understand it, was never in God's heart.
Yep.
For God so loved the world that he gave. God is for us. As soon as Adam and Eve sinned, the Savior is promised, the Lamb slain from the foundation of the Lord, and his foreknowledge he knew all right. And God was always on our side. God is for us. Who can be against us? Okay. The tipping point is our response to him. And that statement tips it towards, oh, I feel so reassured now that I know there's nothing to make him love more or less. Rather than when the tipping point should be, yeah, but are you doing? Is there anything more you can do to receive more, participate more in his love?
Mm-hmm.
See, that's where the tipping is it?
Absolutely.
Okay, so that's why I like to shift that focus.
Yeah, and that's huge, because if we're not careful, there's so many passages that we, like you said, misdirect, and they just end up becoming blankets, you know, or, you know, to live however I want to, because I can't do anything to make him love me less, so it doesn't matter. And right. The scripture is very clear that's not how we should do those things.
So other self-sabotage, we talked about the person who keeps sabotaging relationship fear, but procrastination.
Yeah, or there, you just led into my favorite is I'm waiting on God.
Oh.
The statement, I'm waiting on God. In my opinion, most of the times I have heard that in my life, I look at that person's situation, if I knew him well enough, and it's hard to judge this, you know, but there seemed to be a real sense of you're afraid to fail at something.
But when they say that, do you ever know somebody well enough to say that I'm waiting for God? Do you ever say, waiting on him for what?
I have.
And what kind of answers do you get?
It was mixed. A couple of times it was, you know, well, what do you mean? You know, it was kind of defensive.
Particularly the ones that are procrastinating and or self-sabotaging.
Yeah.
What kind of answers do you get?
There's been some other times where I said that and it's, you know what? You're right. Like, what about what you're delaying doing is against God? You know, I usually bring it back to, does this fall into the category of, you know, there's nothing you're doing opposing God?
But waiting on him for what?
Well, yeah. Are you waiting for the booming voice? Because most of us don't get that. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, sure. Could it happen? Yeah. But also, is it in line with what he would want for your life? And is this a pure thing? Hey, take a chance at it. If it's not in his will, he's gonna do this with you. That something could happen then, you know, but yeah.
So he says he waited on the Lord. Throw the lyrics from a Petra song to them. You know, the good things come to those who wait, not to those who hesitate. So hurry up and wait upon the Lord.
Yeah. I'm going to go back to the 80s. I love me some pets right now.
Isn't that good? Throw that on and see what their head bulls. I'm waiting to look. Are you? Are you really waiting?
Yeah.
Wait on him.
And again, it's a bit of a double-edged sword, because, yes, there are times you are to wait on the Lord.
Yeah.
It is a biblical thing. Yet, I think a lot of times when that is said, it is being used as a shield, you know.
Because the missing piece there is, even when we're called to wait on God, it doesn't mean we're called to be inactive.
Yeah.
You know, Abraham and Sarah waited 25 years before Isaac came, you know, after they received the promise.
Mm-hmm.
But they still had to continue to walk in a faith relationship with God and trust him, and they didn't. But that was what they were supposed to be doing in the process of saying, okay, you know, Israel was given the promise of a Messiah. They were still supposed to be living in accordance with his guides and beyond his purposes to be in connection with him. And so just because I'm waiting doesn't mean I'm inactive. There's still things I'm supposed to be doing.
Remember the story of the farmer?
Yeah.
You know the story? Yeah. The farmer who had this beautiful field of crops, just coming, gorgeous farm. And a man stopped and said, man, I love how the Lord has blessed you with this bountiful harvest. And the farmer looked at him and said, well, you should have seen it when the Lord had it all to himself.
Yeah, exactly right.
I mean, there's a lesson in
mm-hmm.
it. Yeah, and this idea that, of course, the Lord could have had a perfect garden, and he made the earth that way, but in this world now, you know, we have to apply ourselves, don't we?
Sowing and reaping, yeah.
Sowing and reaping.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. So procrastination, and I hadn't heard that one, so I'm glad you brought that one up, but that is a form, isn't it, of yeah. delay and evasion. How about perfectionism? Is this a self-sabotage?
Yes.
I've seen people get caught in this loop of indecision for fear of doing the wrong thing. This scrupulosity. I don't want to do it wrong. I don't want to make a mistake. I'm not sure which the right thing is. I'm not sure if the Lord will have me do this or have me do that. And so they actually do nothing. They actually do nothing. For a long time, they won't do anything because they don't want to do the wrong thing. Have you seen this?
Oh, yeah.
And I've had conversations with many patients over the years, and I will tell our audience, in most decisions of life, I will tell you one exception. Make me name the exception. But most decisions of life, it is better to make the wrong decision than no decision. And the object lesson or metaphor is you're actually out hiking in the backwood, and you come to a fork in the trail. There's no sign. You don't have a compass. You're not sure which way to go. It's better to actually pick a trail and go than to sit there and make no decision because yeah. you're stuck.
Mm-hmm.
Once you pick a trail, at some point down that wrong trail, you will gather enough information, this is not the right trail. And you'll go back and you'll go down the other one. But if you stay stuck, you never go anywhere. That's a metaphor for life. You come to a decision point in life and some people get stuck. Well, I don't know if I should take, and I've seen this when it comes to like college education. I'm not sure what career I want. Okay, fine. Just pick some classes and go. My wife did this back when she first started college classes, or as a college freshman. She started out declared as an accounting major. And she took her first semester of accounting classes. And she knew that was not the right calling, and she went down a different trail.
That's right.
Okay. But had she not started that and just said, I don't know. And I've seen people, they never go because they never actually make a decision and they can never figure it out. Sometimes you make that wrong decision. That gives you new information to help clarify your decision on a different one.
That's right. Or they stay in that wrong decision because they're stuck. They're treading water, and they never get out of it, and then they're miserable
yeah.
because they stayed in the
wrong. But that's not the healthy approach, is it?
Yeah,
okay,
not at all.
Okay, but the one place I would say it is better to make no decision than to make the wrong decision, this is the one for sure, marriage. If you're not sure this is the marriage partner for you, it's uncertainty, I'm not sure, maybe not, put it off. Do not make that decision. That one you delay, but a college class. I'm not sure if I should take this job. If there's not I can't see a reason not to, but I'm not sure it's the right. And you don't have any other input, take the job.
Take a chance.
You will actually, in that employment, get new information to inform you whether that's the job or not. Is that true?
Absolutely.
Okay? And there's no sin in that. There's some people live in fear of making the wrong decision. Oh, but I'll have wasted a semester of school if I take the wrong. No, there's no waste in that because you learned something. You learned accounting's not for you, okay?
Yeah.
And you didn't know that until you took that. That's not a waste. And many people misunderstand. They trap themselves in false conclusions like, well, if I take the class and I don't end up in the career, I wasted that. That's not a waste. You learned something.
And there's also the side trail of that is, you know, I've met so many people that believe that God leads our life like Hansel and Gretel by breadcrumbs. that I've got to wait to get the next breadcrumb, or I'm out of God's will for my life because I didn't go. I'm not going to go to college until I know what God's will is for my college program. Because then if I take those accounting classes, I'm outside the will of God. And they actually think that God's will, and we've talked about this in different programs, of it's not like Hansel and Gretel, one breadcrumb at a time. And if I'm not, then I'm off the path and I'm in sin. When the Spirit of the Lord is a freedom.
Well, know? Not only that, though, if I were talking to that person, I'd say, what do you actually think the will of the Lord is for you? Mm-hmm. Isn't the will of the Lord in Hebrews 5:14 for all of us that we grow up and become mature Christians who develop by practice the ability to discern right from wrong?
Yeah.
How are you going to develop the practice that you know what a healthy decision is if somebody actually tells you every decision? How will you know how to do math problems if every math problem you've ever given, the teacher tells you the answer immediately and you never work any?
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So yes, there's a place when we're children that we have somebody tell us the answers and show us how to do the problems. But isn't it true that when you're learning math, that there's some problems that they leave you to wrestle with and you get them wrong, and then somebody comes along and shows you why it was wrong and you learn from that? Okay. So yes, God is going to teach you the basic principles, but then he's going to leave you to make some choices that are not evil. It's not about evil or good, this job or that job, this class or that class. It's about how you prioritize decision-making so that you can learn that ability. How else are you going to learn that if you actually always wait for somebody to tell you the answer? So the very thing you're saying is, I want to do what God would have me do, you're actually not doing. He wants you to exercise your ability to think, weigh evidences, prioritize, make a decision, and learn from it.
That's huge. That's good.
Yeah. So self-advertise the perfectionist, living in fear of making mistakes. And we've said this before. There is a big difference from making mistakes and choosing evil. And would you believe I said this on another podcast? I got all kinds of feedback that making mistakes are evil. I gave the example of, there's a difference between making a math error in your check registry, believing you have $1,000 when you have $100, and therefore you write a $200 check that bounces. That is not the same as knowing there's no money in writing fraudulent checks.
Mm-hmm.
Those are not the same things.
That's right.
They look similarly on the surface, but they're completely different. One's an innocent. As soon as you make it, you immediately make up the difference and you pay whatever the overdraft fees are. And, mm-hmm. and there's no evil in that. That's a human error. But I got pushback from people who say, oh no, that's sin. You make a mistake, that's sin.
It's called perfectionism. You just hit on that a second.
But see, that focus is also on external behavior. Yeah. And the Lord focuses on the motive. And the example I gave is motive of heart. That's where the real deal is.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, like we've talked about this before in different conversations. But the reason why Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount goes back to the heart is because so many people had worked loopholes into the law of Moses. You know, they would say, oh, well, you know, you can, you know, do this. I don't like this wife, so I can get rid of her. You know, I can afford to pay another dowry, another bride price, so I can just do this over and over again until I can basically say, no, if you're committing adultery in your heart, that's adultery. It's not working the loopholes of the legal system. It's not being legalistic and saying, oh, see, I followed all the rules. God looks way deeper than that.
Yeah. So the self-sabotage.
Yes.
Isn't it coming from some mechanic of people who are really probably running from some wound in the heart?
Mm-hmm.
So, something that they're afraid will happen if they succeed. One of them is make mistakes. Another one is some people don't want responsibility. They absolutely, and some people, they self-sabotage because in their childhood, there are generally two categories of injury in childhood, categories, big categories.
Mm-hmm.
Overt injury, harm inflicted, physical, sexual abuse of some inflicted harm. Neglect and deficit of something positive that wasn't provided. So no affirmation, no love, no holding, no compassionate care, but also no overt abuse.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But these are two different types of wounds. Some people come out of homes where there's no overt abuse, but they were never actually loved. They never experienced themselves loved. And so there's this deficit and this craving, this longing to be valued for who they are, to be loved. And until you experience yourself as loved, you don't actually want to take on the responsibilities. And so some people sabotage and keep themselves in an emotionally childlike, infantile state to... because they're seeking that that nurturing, that caring, that love is what they're seeking. And they don't want to be independent. They don't want to be autonomous because then they can't get the love they're looking for. This happens. It's not uncommon. And you see it in a pattern of people who are in psychiatric circles presenting with a variety of complaints of distress, depression, anxiety, unhappiness. And then any interventions that are brought that would result, if applied, toward their getting well, there's a pattern of sabotage. I can't take that. It causes side effects. It's too expensive. That won't work for me. I can't do this. No, that is not helpful. There's always a but I really do want your help. Help, but don't actually get me well.
Mm-hmm.
And when you see that pattern over time, it's a good indicator that this individual has a really deep void in their heart where they've never really experienced love. And what they're actually longing for and the thing that's missing is that love for who they are as a person.
Now, when we have self-talk, right, this inner critic, is there a healthy way to fix that? I mean, like, lies believe, right? We talk about this, you know, that we have power over what we believe has power over us. That's powerful, right? Understanding. But if I'm afraid of rejection, if I'm afraid of embarrassment, and this is what's leading to my self-sabotage, how do we overcome that inner self? I know we've talked about how to change habits, but how do we actually adjust the way we talk to ourselves about ourselves?
It's the only path of healing is truth. The question is, how does a person access truth?
Mm-hmm.
If this pattern of what you described is not going to be truthful.
Right.
There may be factual truths. For instance, a child was physically or sexually abused, factually true. But that leads to patterns of thinking that are untrue. I'm no good. I'm unlovable. I'm ugly. I'm dirty. I'm nasty. I'm a loser. Life is, there's no men are trustworthy. No women are trustworthy, whatever. Okay. It leads to untruths that become foundational patterns of thinking. And then it inflames fear and insecurity, doubt of others. If I get close to people, they'll hurt me too. So these deep patterns of processing, believing, and expecting get established. The only path forward is truth. How can they access the truth is the question. Mm-hmm. And it's truth, not truth comprehended or cognitively recognized that heals. It is truth that once it's cognitively recognized, it's chosen and internalized. For instance, I have many patients who have had these types of varied dynamics. And they will articulate, I know I'm a child of God, as a cognitive truth.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no internalization of that where they actually experience that as part of who they are.
Right.
They don't experience it as a princess of the king of the universe, for instance. It doesn't formulate a sense of value and being loved. They still feel abandoned and uncared for. It. Often it can even work against them. I know I'm a child of God and he didn't care enough to protect me when I was growing up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think there's a really important thing that you just said too, and just how we see other people. I mean, if we can really, there was something I learned, you know, when going through a really difficult time in my own life that, you know, I'd been in ministry, right, for 20 years. And it was almost like this light bulb came on. I had always seen myself and others as God's children, right? I had never really internalized it about others as much as I did about myself. So I did actually see myself as God's child, but then had I ever actually looked at my wife as God's daughter? That's a different statement. Like when you say my wife or you say God's daughter, you know, it's like when you go to, you know, dad for the hand in marriage kind of thing. It's a very different viewpoint. And I think if we can see how what you were just describing and look at other people the same way, not just about ourselves, but I think it would change a lot of things for us. Because if we're going to treat others as a child of God, it's a much harder to harm them. Mm-hmm. It's much harder, especially intentionally, you know.
But I think the self-saboteur, you know, it's love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and neighbor as yourself. They can't get to where you're going as long as they're filled with all of the distortions and corruptions about themselves that are untrue. Mm-hmm. So the healing has to start with their own connection with their Heavenly Father and the purging out of their heart of the distortions and falsehoods about the self. Their identity is distorted and warped because of real life events that are not false. Those things happen, but when those things happen, and the younger we are, the more distorted they are as they enter in. This is why I think Jesus said, woe to those who harm the children.
Yeah.
Whoa. You know, you harm an adult that has a healthy sense of self, they can be wounded and they have things, but they have a foundation of who they are and they know they are in Christ. They can work through that much easier than the child who hasn't formed their sense of self yet. And all this trauma gets woven into the fabric of their forming self and gets distorted. A simple metaphor that I use with patients sometimes. Imagine a young college couple, they're poor, don't have a lot of money, so they shop at a flea market. And they need a new mirror for their home. They don't have one. And they find a full-length mirror to hang on the back of their door for 50 cents. And it's 50 cents because the bottom one-third's all water damage and warped. But the top third, two-thirds are fine. So they buy it, put it on the back of their door. A few years go by, they have their first child. A few more years go by, and that child's about 2-3 years of age. And one day that child walks into their house, walks into their bedroom, turns around and sees themselves in the mirror, and they see the ugliest, grotesque, twisted face they've ever seen. They run out onto the playground. They see all the beautiful children. They run back in and they see their face. Oh, their shame. They're so ugly. They go to their room and they get their crayons and a paper bag and the best they can, they draw a pretty face. And whenever they go out now in public, they always wear this paper bag, but all the other kids are laughing at them now, and they know that they can see how ugly their face is. By the time they get to high school, though, they're pretty good at wearing a mask. You're following the metaphor here? Mm-hmm. Now, in our metaphor, is the problem that this child has with their actual face or the image they have in their head about their face? What's the problem?
It's the image, yeah.
Okay. This is kids who go through childhood maltreatment. The mirror in the metaphor are the adults in our life growing up. They're reflecting back to us. That's why little kids are constantly going, Mom, Dad, see no hands. Mom, Dad, look at this. Constantly coming to Mom and Dad because they have no idea. Color in a coloring book. They have no idea whether they did good or bad. They need someone to tell them. That's why they're always wanting your feedback. How am I doing? Am I okay? Am I beautiful? Am I lovable? Am I valuable? That's the constantly seeking because they have no idea. They don't know when a child comes up, left, right, up, down, skies, blue, grass. They don't know anything. So they're constantly looking. If you have distorted parents who are abusive and toxic, then they internalize a very warped image of self. And then they come into the world. Then they come into adulthood. And let's say they come into adult because they were traumatized and they have this distorted. It's not who they really are. It's the image they hold inside about the self. But it causes them to interact with people with masks. And so they wear a mask. And they're pretty good at wearing it. Most people can't tell they're wearing one by the time they're an adult. But when people start to get close and start to peek under the mask, they don't feel comfortable. They get stressed. They'll self-sabotage. Get away. You can't see me. They'll sabotage, get that too close. Occasionally, they might get close enough to somebody that they allow to look under the mask. Maybe they've had a lot of problems. They've seen the therapist and they've actually opened up for the first time to the therapist. Or they've maybe a pastor, somebody at church that they really have seen something different in it, and they let them see below the mask. And so in our metaphor, they take the mask off and they look for the first time in an accurate mirror and they see a beautiful face. You know what they say? That's wonderful. That's beautiful. I wish that was me. That's not me. And so when they actually hear honest feedback, yeah, you're great. I love you. You're an amazing, you got great character traits, this, that, or the other thing. God, whatever. That's wonderful to hear. But inside they go, but that's not me. And then once they're finally convinced, let's say they're convinced, okay, all right, that is my face. One look in the mirror and they replace that image they've carried for their whole life. One look. Or they have to spend hours and hours in front of the mirror making faces and touching themselves until they finally replace it. And the mirror that they have to look at is the mirror of truth. Mm-hmm. And this is where a good Christian therapist, counselor, can help them. Because what we do in therapy, we don't tell people what to think. We simply reflect. We share what we're seeing. And what's what a mirror does? A mirror shows you what you're showing it. But a mirror doesn't change anything. You go to a mirror and you got dirt on your face. Mirror doesn't judge you. mirror just gives you back. Now, if the mirror's warped, it can give you a warped image.
Mm-hmm.
But you want a healthy, and that's where I think Christian counseling is better. You'll get more accurate reflections coming back. But at the end of the day, you still have to make your own judgments about what's accurate, what's not. You ever look in a funhouse mirror? Tall, skinny. Everything coming out of a funhouse mirror is not warped. If you're wearing blue jeans, you will see blue jeans. Mm-hmm. So some of the things are still true. But it warps things. People will give reflections through the warp of their own lens, through the warp of their own mind. And this is why every person must be fully persuaded in their own mind. And so even patients in therapy have to still keep their own good judgment about them and hear what the therapist is saying and take and think. And so, again, I tell my patients, I'm not here to tell you what to think. I'll reflect this back at you. I'll give you a perspective. But you've got to come to your own conclusion on this. And then you've got to make decisions on it. And so you look in the mirror and you see dirt on your face. And because you're in a play and you're a military officer in a play and you're in a combat zone and you've got dirt right where you want it. You want to leave that dirt there. It's exactly where you want the dirt. Okay. On the other hand, you're getting ready to go into your wedding. Oh, I want that dirt off my face. Okay. So what you see might be exactly what you want from the therapist or the person giving you feedback, pastoral counselor, or it may be something you'd like to change. But the therapist or the counselor doesn't make the change. The patient does.
Mm-hmm.
By internalizing truth and saying, no, that's a lie. And when that old idea comes out, well, no, that's a lie. That's not true. This is the truth. This is who I am in Christ. And so over time, their sense of self changes. And one of the dynamics with these types of internalizations and distortions that lead to self-sabotage is not simply the facts of what happened, but the negative emotions associated with what happened. The event felt gross, felt disgusting, felt revolting, because it was. You get molested, you get raped, that's disgusting.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens is, oftentimes, especially with sexual trauma, is that the feelings associated with the event do not stay attached to the event. They become attached to the self. And from that moment forward, the individual feels that they're ugly or they're gross or they're dirty or they're nasty. When in fact, because that's how the event felt, when in fact the feelings are very righteous to the event. I give the example of falling into a cow manure and getting cow manure in your face when you were six. That would be gross and disgusting, wouldn't it? And yeah, but you went home, you showered, you listened. Today, as we think about that, it happened. Isn't it still true that was a gross, disgusting experience? Yes, it was. Always will be. Does that make you a gross, disgusting person because of that? Well, no. Kids who go through trauma don't get that. Those feelings don't stay attached to the gross experience. They become attached. They feel that way about themselves. And so part of the healing journey, how we self-sabotaging, is that we actually have to reprocess in truth. Yeah, those feelings were righteous to the event. They never belonged to me. But if you fell in that cow pie when you were six, self-sabotage, how this happens. And even though you've showered, even though you've Listerined a million times, today, everywhere you go, you still smell manure. You actually do. You smell it. You smell it and you smell like you think you smell like it. Will that affect your decision making? Will you be comfortable in the medical convention? Will you be comfortable with the clean church crowd? Or you be comfortable in Skid Row with the homeless? And you self-sabotage. Why are you self-sabotaging? Because you haven't actually processed your trauma and you've associated with yourself revolting and disgusting elements and attributes that do not belong and never belong to you. They did belong to the experience. That was a gross experience. See how this?
Yeah.
And this is where, you know, good Christian counseling can help a person process. We don't change history. History never changes. Our internal experience, process, understanding, and as we are able to bring truth to bear, not just cognitive, but experiential truth, you experience yourself in truth and who you are as a child of God, and you can, in truth, put those feelings where they belong. Then you can actually experience healing, and then suddenly you're more comfortable in different crowds, in different people, and you don't need to self-sabotage.
That's good. That's good.
Any other thoughts about self-sabotage?
Well, hopefully this, you know, talking about it helps. You know, I think one of the things that can be really easy we talk about those internal lies is that because we don't talk about it, it keeps power over us. But as we start bringing this stuff to light, I think it's a big part of the reason why the early church, you know, when, you know, James wrote to, you know, the his, you know, the church that he was writing to in his letter, he told them to confess their sins to one another so they could be healed. You know, confessing my sin to somebody else doesn't give me forgiveness or healing from them. You know, God's the one that gives that, but the healing is the me telling it to you and you helping me continue to see truth. And
but there's something else there. It's very valuable. It's what the 12 steps offers.
Mm-hmm.
You're exactly right. It's only helpful if, number one, they've had that rebirth experience and already experienced God's grace in their life.
Yes.
But what does sin naturally do to the heart and mind of the sinner? Not only causes guilt, it causes shame. Mm-hmm. Shame causes fear. Fear that you won't be loved, you won't be accepted, so you isolate. And so this bearing each other's burdens, this confession, is not for the healing of the soul, it is the removal of the shame.
That's right.
And that's so that you can actually be part of community. And it can only be done if, in fact, you've had that rebirth experience where you are changing the inner man. That's why you go to the 12 steps. I'm Joe, I'm an alcoholic. And what do you hear? Welcome, Joe. It removes the shame. You're not ashamed. And only in then acknowledging that I am helpless over my alcohol, my life's become unmanageable. And step two, and a power higher than myself, starting there without shame. But if you live in shame, you can't actually acknowledge that, then you can't get the help. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I hope this program was helpful for you. If you've struggled with self-sabotage, do a little reflection. And if you don't see the answer yourself, maybe some pastoral or Christian counseling would be helpful to serve as a mirror to help you see aspects that maybe it's hard for you to see for yourself. If you have questions, send those in to questions@designformore.net, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you for joining us on Designed for More, brought to you by Come and Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Also, don't forget to check out our other podcasts for more inspiring content.